Good evening. The question of flying saucers or no flying saucers has been with us since a man named Dahl claimed on June 21st, 1947, to have seen six large airborne discs. Sometime after that, experienced airmen reported unidentified flying objects. From 1947 to 1962, 7,369 UFO, unidentified flying objects, have been reported to the United States Air Force. Controversy surrounds this subject. Many supersonic jets, as well as balloons, are reported as UFOs under adverse weather and sighting conditions. Man-made satellites in orbit have confused many sky watchers. Highly technical electronic systems track everything that moves across our skies without positive identification yet as a flying saucer as such. Yet reports of flying saucers persist. We will try to resolve this question of flying saucers with the evidence at hand. Our distinguished panel is made up of George Adamski, an expert on flying saucers from Vista, California. Dr. Norman L. Trott, president at Wesley Theological Seminary. Dr. Mark Harrison, chairman of the physics department at American University. And Dr. B.L. Clock, astronomer at the U.S. Naval Observatory. We will begin our discussion in just a moment.
This is Raymond Burr speaking for the 1964 Freedom's Roll Call. Now, there's a word for you, freedom. What does it conjure up in your mind? The Revolution, the Constitution, the 4th of July, two world wars? Perhaps when you think of freedom, you think of working where you please, traveling where you want, worshiping as you like, the American way. Or maybe your mind leaps to the hundreds of millions living under the chains of communism, people who have lost their freedom. Or maybe you just never think of freedom at all. May I remind you that freedom is a precious thing, that it must be protected and cherished, lest it be lost or destroyed. I invite you to join with me in learning what we can do for freedom. Ask today for a copy of Freedom's Handbook. Write to Freedom's Foundation, Valley Forge, Pennsylvania.
Well, gentlemen, in our opening film sequence, we have seen what purports to be a flying saucer. This film was taken by Mr. Adamski, who makes claims of seeing flying saucers on a number of occasions. I think it would be best to start off with him and ask him how, in the face of overwhelming evidence against flying saucers, do you still claim, sir, that there is such a thing as flying saucers, the film notwithstanding?
Well, having a personal experience, at one time I didn't believe him either because brought up as an amateur astronomer and what we've been taught and so forth seemed to be impossible. But after years of experience and so forth and coming close contact with them, I can't help but believe. Just like in the early days, after all, there were seven planets known, and when the eighth one was coming in forth finally, and the ninth one, there was a lot of discussion, too, on that they didn't exist.
Oh, Dr. Clark, as an astronomer, can you buy this line of thinking?
Well, first of all, I'd like to ask Mr. Adamski if he's familiar with Edward Ruppelt's views on this subject.
Yes, I have. I got a tape recording. He came up to see me, and I got a tape recording home of his own statements there.
Right. Well, in his recent book on unidentified flying objects, he states that he does not believe in flying saucers.
Naturally, in the position he has placed, he has to state that way, but personally, talking to him, very fine man, you know, he passed away not long ago. And personally, they all admit more or less. I know a lot of them that have come to me and told me and supported me, yet I did not use their name in my defense because, well, they would just get in trouble.
Well, many of the photographs that have been published and shown in the newspapers and so on could very well have been pictures of astronomical phenomena, which I'm sure you're familiar with. One is the super meteor or bolide.
Oh, yeah.
And
I agree with you. When there is something genuine happens, and it's been that way for centuries, there's a bunch of opportunities to spring up and bring up a lot of things that confuse the issue and causes the knowledge to be thrown back rather than coming forward. I realize that, and I'm aware of it.
Mr. Adamski, you claim to have seen flying saucers on a number of occasions. Why do you think you have seen flying saucers so frequently, and The rest of us have never seen a flying saucer.
Well, you can't stay in the building and see them. You got to watch it. When you watch the sky like we have watched there at the beginning, every night and every night, you're bound to be seeing somewhere. The average person, most of the cases, doesn't do that. And
Will you describe for us, sir, what these look like?
Well, they're scouts, what they call scouts, are carried by the mothership, the long one that you just saw there on the screen. Well, they're round ones, and they only travel from the mothership to Earth and go back into it. And the motherships, like our airplane carriers, are the ones that carry them between the planets. Well, this year, small ones, like called flying saucer, are, you may say, will accommodate about six people at the most. Some of them don't accommodate that much. While the motherships, the cigar-shaped type, they carry these and accommodate a crew of at least 50 to a couple of hundred.
Where would they come from?
Well, they come from Mars, Venus, and one other planet known now, and that'd be Saturn, although there are some reported to be coming from Jupiter as well.
You say known?
Yeah.
What do you
because
mean
when I made a trip around the world in 59, I've got many reports from different ones, very reliable sources, even in England from the Defense Department when I had luncheon with them.
Dr. Trott, how about this?
I was wondering what his position was on the habitability of these planets. Is it conceivable that they could sustain life?
There have been many ways to interpret the data which we have from Mars and Venus regarding the atmospheric composition of these planets. And many astronomers argue that there can be life, and many argue that there can't be life on Mars and Venus. However, on most of the other planets in our solar system, I would say 99.99% of the astronomers are definite in their views that life could not possibly exist on these planets as we know it here on Earth today. For example, on Jupiter and Saturn, which you just mentioned, the atmospheric composition of these planets is primarily composed of methane and ammonia. Methane and ammonia is not too good to breathe.
Yeah.
And I'd like to get back to one point which you made earlier, though, in which you mentioned that you observe these objects because you watch for them quite frequently. We have a professional program, you might say, called Project Moonwatch, which Dr. Alan Hynek headed. And according to Dr. Hynek, all of the objects which his people looked for, and all the hours that were spent making the observations, no one ever reported an unidentified flying
object. Well, I again have information on that also from the Moon Watch, where they report it, but they never reported to the public. This thing is quite pleatry in you when you get a book that instructs you how to do it. If you're a Moon Watcher or a watcher of any kind, they tell you definitely to be careful and observe that and report it as best you can. Try to get the size, speed, and all of that.
All right. Dr. Trott, as a theologian, what is your view of the possibility of a being coming from outer space to this Earth on a flying saucer-type object?
Well, I don't think there'd be any problem at this point. I don't believe that from a theological point of view, even from a scriptural point of view, that you can rule out the possibility of human beings somewhere else in the universe. Indeed, I think it's quite probable. So that this doesn't give me any difficulty, and there are cues in scriptures that might shore up your point of view. In Ezekiel, for example, if you can pick up the spiritual, which picks up the idea in Ezekiel, Ezekiel saw a wheel way up in the middle of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Whether this was a dream or whether it was a reality is something we really don't know. There isn't any problem at this point of view. I think our problem is the problem of evidence. Really, can you pinpoint this, and can we conceive of beings on other planets more advanced than the beings on our own making this kind of flight this time? And I'm anxious to hear what the astronomer says and the physicist says.
We have an interesting subject to follow you up on it. We have an interesting subject that just came to me before I went on the trip. This is the article here in German, and it was copied from an Italian, and it is the Vatican official paper, the Observatore Romano, published this, and it says in there, the Vatican is already training space missionaries. And quite an interesting article, what they intend to do, what they suspect. So they already informed or know more about it, that they're preparing the youngsters already to be missionaries to go on other planets, and in order to transmit their type of belief to the people on other worlds.
Mr. Adams, in your opening statement, did I understand you to say that something about six passengers are provisioned for six passengers on the scout ship?
On the scout ship, yeah, from two to six.
How did you get those information?
The one I made a contact with the first time out in the desert, the side of Blight, which is in California yet, there were two men, and I didn't get to see the other one, but the one that I talked to at that time on the ground, I've seen the other one only through...
You talked to the one?
Yeah, through reflection there in the ship. But there were two in that one.
How did you talk to one?
I didn't talk to him like we talk here, because it was pretty odd. I did talk that way, and it seemed that he didn't answer me, although he seemed to understand me. So I started gestures and so forth, and of course we all know that the thought of pressures can be imposed upon another person and so forth, that they're alerted, and I tried to do that because I studied that angle too. And seemed like he understood that I anyhow got him to understand that I want to know where he was from. And so by gestures, I pointed through the sun, and then I made a first orbit, and I says Mercury, and a second orbit Venus, and third orbit Earth, and pointed to that. I did that twice. He finally did the same thing and stopped at the second orbit to give me the answer of Venus. And I said Venus, and he nodded his hand.
Dr. Harrison?
Well, I remember Mr. Adamski telling about this in his book, which he wrote with Desmond Leslie. There were several things surprised me there. You indicated that these people look very much like people who live on the Earth.
That's right. They do look like it. Any one of us could be one of them. On the other hand, I don't see why a creator would have another geometrical pattern for human beings instead of following the normal pattern as we know ourselves. We may be different minds and different maybe sizes and all of that, but I think that the creator would follow the pattern straight through.
Well, now, this surprises me a great deal. I remember in reading Dick Tracy and Dyett Smith paid a visit to the moon. The thing that rather intrigued me was the idea that the creator of the Dick Tracy comic strip chose to draw these people very much like people on Earth.
What is this picture? Brent?
Yes, for example.
This is a picture from Mr. Adamski's book,
mm-hmm.
showing the spaceman that Mr. Yeah. Adamski says he saw, and there was an artist with you at the time.
Yes, I'd sketched that picture.
Well, now let me tell you what I feel is surprising about the fact that they would be similar in shape and size to human beings as we know them. I'll tell you my thoughts about Dick Tracy first, if that's relevant. The moon has a very low gravitational field.
Mm-hmm.
And when you examine the sort of speak of whys and wherefores that people are the size they are,
mm-hmm.
it turns out there are very good reasons why they're the size that they are,
mm-hmm.
that they function well at this particular size and not some other size. For example, if we were 10 times the size that we are, it would be rather difficult to get a bone structure that would support us. Just the sheer weight of the thing. We'd have to have a different way of forming bone structure out of the minerals we eat and so
mm-hmm.
forth, because it wouldn't have the strength to support us. So that the size that we are is well suited to our particular size of the Earth and the associated gravitational pull. Now, these planets differ widely in size.
And gravity.
And gravity. Could perhaps Dr. Clark could...
I would like to comment something on that. On that, too. Let's go back to our structure of the present day. I'm 73 years old. I've gone through 73 years of life here. And I have seen in my time, when I was a kid starting out in labor, I've seen in my time men here on Earth. Very heavy structure because they had to do everything by hand, digging ditches, sewers, and all of that. And since we have machines, notice our present generation is still the same design, same structure, but a much lighter structure in bone and everything else. Nature seems to take care of that.
Well, I like they're relatively the same. Within 10
I watched the Olympic trials last week and I saw some very big fellows going there.
Well, Dr. Clark, could I address a question
yes.
to you? Could you quote some figures on the relative gravitational forces on other planets?
Well, for example, the moon, that's about 1/6 that of the Earth mm-hmm. as far as the gravitational
forces. It'd be a wonderful place to play a baseball
right.
game, wouldn't it?
You get a home run every time.
I don't have the exact figures, but I think Jupiter is about 30 times the gravitational attraction of the Earth.
And that would seem to call for smaller people, wouldn't it?
Well, it depends. I don't know if you need someone smaller or larger to support this heavy force, which would be pulling you down towards the center of gravity on the planet. You may need someone with something that was larger.
No, I would think smaller, because consider the ant. He can fall off this table and not hurt himself.
I see. in other words, you might think that the person would be spread out in this coordinate
yes,
more than that coordinate.
If he falls, think what a bone-crushing experience that would be. With 30 times the gravitational force.
Well, something's
breathing.
That's
why you have flying saucers instead of flying cups.
And where do we get the answer on the gravity as being exact to begin with? From our instruments. And our instruments still need improvement. Let me remind you of something here just a little while back, which we sent up the second satellite up there and it's supposed to register and bring that message back of outer space and also register what's on Earth. Combination in order to get some kind of a measuring stick there by which we could go. And my God, it registered no oxygen on Earth.
Dr. Harrison, let's talk about the spacecraft that we have seen on this film. We have heard of saucers and the cigar-type objects. We saw at the beginning of the program what appeared to be the movements of a fly in a rush in all directions at once. As a physicist, is this... what do you think of this?
Well, I would like to say tell you the following story. On Labor Day weekend, I had my boat down to Smith Island, which, as you know, is in the lower part of the Chesapeake Bay. And I was running across to Solomon's Island on a Sunday morning. And I saw an unidentified object in the sky and started to call it to a friend of mine that was sailing with me. And I looked a few minutes later and it was gone before I had a chance to call it to his attention. About an hour went by and I saw it again. Mm-hmm. And once again, I tried to call it to his attention, but he was busy doing other things. The third time I succeeded in calling it to his attention, so he saw it also. Now, at the time, I didn't give a great deal of thought to it. I thought, well, it's something and that's the end of it. Something, I don't know what it is, but... I didn't jump to any hasty conclusion. It was just something that I didn't know what it was. Later on, we got over Solomon's Island, and then I had some second thoughts about it. My first thought was that I noticed a balloon salesman, and one of them was already some kid had turned loose on and it took off. So I said, well, there's a possibility. The other possibility, I suddenly realized that the Patuxent Naval Air Base was very nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what they work with, but certainly they must use some targets of some kind. Now, how is my observations different in kind than yours? See, my being sort of a natural skeptic, I started looking around for plausible reasons. And the notion of flying saucers never occurred to me until I saw this book of yours.
Mm-hmm. You are right. Prior to our big radar system that we have today, at the beginning from 46 on, you noticed they didn't have any, and there were more sightings also seen. But today we have a lot of things to observe them, and plus then we've got 500 pieces or more of debris flying around in space that we have put up there since we started dealing with space. And any one of those could be reported as a flying saucer. But this also could be confirmed because the Air Force follows these objects right along in order to know where they are at a given time. And reported, they check on it and know whether it's flying saucer or is a debris.
Mr. Adamski, the Air Force says this. To date, no unidentified flying object has given any indication of threat to the national security. There has been no evidence submitted or discovered by the Air Force that unidentified sightings represented technological developments or principles beyond the range of our present-day scientific knowledge. And finally, there has been nothing in the way of evidence or other data to indicate that these unidentified sightings were extraterrestrial vehicles under intelligent control. How do you like the Air Force?
Well, here's a statement, a this year's statement in January 9, 1964, given at Winston-Salem and to the Torch Club. So far as the Air Force, Mr. Benson, who is very closely connected when you're in all the branches of the government. He cracked up in a plane.
And did you say what branch?
Huh?
Did you tell us what branch?
Well, he's the one that also established this institution down in Winston-Salem, what they call, can't think of it there. Still educational institution. I know it very well, and I just right now can't think of it. He is founder of that. But he was closely connected. He was in Washington most of the time. And it says the Air Force experts are concerned. They are not always. They are not foreign nation or extraterrestrial or minister to the United States. And down here, they go on and state here, it is reasonable that the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. government will not go on an official record of non-identified negotic definitely exist or extraterrestrial or controlled by intelligent beings or not hostile. But it against whom we have no defense if they should choose hostility, an announcement of this would create a mass hysteria perhaps far greater than the single radio broadcast Orson was 25 years ago. And then they go on 25% of the Air Force and 1,000 to 2,000 saucer reports from the military pilots and airline pilots, General Stafford said, but not even these contain, you're correct,
Could I interrupt you for a minute here? You mentioned just about two or three minutes ago that there were many more radar and means by which we could examine or search for these UFOs today.
Yeah.
You agree to that?
Yeah.
All right. Then how do you count, since there are more receptors or objects to receive the information, for the fact that there have been fewer and fewer sightings reported since 1952?
Because of that, because they stay on beyond the radar screen and or commander. Every now and then, they don't come and just fly like they did before, where 500 stood over Farmington in 1952. See, all day long.
But I think our surveillance systems are probably superior to what they were in 1952.
And it is, as far as our military is concerned, if they were to release what they catch today, which they could, and someday they will, I think we'd all be pretty much surprised. But this is the point that they want to bring here. Accurate information in size, speed, altitude, directions have not been even gotten by this. So now the Air Force is switching from a shotgun approach. See, up to this time, shotgun approach. Collecting mass of reports to attempt to get a correct measurement so scientists will have something to work with, the general sense.
Mr. Adams, do you think the Air Force is taking a position then that there are flying saucers?
Definitely.
Dr. Clark, what do you think of this?
Well, I don't know. This is not my field. I wanted to ask a question that takes us off into another tack. Here, the astonishing thing to me, above everything else, is the fact that you have seen flying saucers at hand and have talked to the inhabitants of them. Has this occurred with any frequency in recent years that you know? Have others seen experienced contact with the residents of
Yeah, others
saucers?
Have seen it in this country about four or five other people. There's many claims of it that they're not all up to par. And then throughout the world is about that many, too. In fact, the last time I was in Europe, which was a little over a year ago, I talked to John Pope, too, and I've learned quite a bit what the Vatican knew, because he even gave me a little medal. And I'm glad to have it now, because he passed away since then.
Dr. Clark, I meant to come to you for this question about the Air Force and apparently their revised position on flying saucers. What would your reaction be to this?
Well, I don't know what the latest information is. All I have available is what Mr. Ruppelt had in his book. Mm-hmm. And this was...
But notice as far as Captain Ruppelt is concerned, you know, that Scoutmaster, he questions there. What burned that grass underneath there? The grass were all right and the roots were all burned down. And they're all electrical chips. He questioned that toward the last on
and the scoutmaster.
Mr. Clarkson, I didn't do justice to your earlier question regarding the film trip. I did have some questions I was trying to work my way around to.
Please do now, sir. We only have a couple of moments.
Mr. Adamski, could you estimate how fast you think this object was traveling that was going
this
into...
This object that we saw?
Mm-hmm.
I would say at least 15,000 miles per hour, I would say, according to the way it's moving, although it may be much faster.
Was it in our Earth's atmosphere, you think?
That's right. It was within at Earth's atmosphere. I would say if the height and the distance basis is to be judged, not correct because it wasn't there to measure it exactly, but I would say that it probably was at 5,000 to 10,000 feet above the ground.
Well, here's something that bothers me. To the best of our knowledge today, you can't move an object at supersonic speed. And this is supersonic speed
mm-hmm.
we're talking about through the atmosphere without getting a sonic boom. Now, how do you account for that absence?
It's hard to tell whether this object produced a sonic boom or it didn't, because when I saw it, it was already moving and entered our atmosphere, so that the sonic boom would have been gone, and then that territory, this guy...
Well, the sonic boom stays with an object as it moves.
No. It doesn't stay because I've seen it on myself, our own jets break my sonic... In that territory, there's Camp Pendleton. Almost every day, you got it. They break the sonic boom and they go on, and you watch them, and if it disappears, no more sound.
No, the sonic boom is when the particular shockwave traveling out
passes
by where you happen to be standing.
Yeah. Well,
gentlemen, I'm sorry I must interrupt. Time has run out. I don't think we have resolved the question of whether there is such a thing as flying saucers or not, and we'll have to leave that up to the audience. We'll be back in just a moment.
We would like to thank our guests for being with us tonight for this most interesting discussion. Our thanks to George Adamski, expert on flying saucers from Vista, California, Dr. Norman L. Trott, president of Wesley Theological Seminary, Dr. Mark Harrison, chairman of the physics department at American University, Dr. B.L. Clark, astronomer at the U.S. Naval Observatory. We hope you will be with us again when Community Dialogue discusses another topic of interest to Washington area. This is Harry Clarkson. Good night.